This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. The Cold War may be over, but the nuclear arsenals built over that period continue to pose concerns. Among them are the aging stockpiles of America's nuclear weapons still safe to store. Military planners, meanwhile, wonder if those weapons will still work, should they be used, and some are asking if the U.S. should be looking to develop a new generation of nukes. Earlier this month, President Bush submitted his budget proposal to Congress, which included funding to study nuclear weapons, commonly called bunker busters, a provision which Congress rejected late last year. Meanwhile, nuclear scientists at U.S. weapons laboratories have recently begun to design bigger, sturdier weapons with longer lifespans. Weapons critics argue that these efforts undermine anti-proliferation treaties and could instigate another arms race. Later in the program, a new census report says that recent waves of immigrants have been better educated than previous generations. But now we're talking about the nuclear stockpile and what we have now, where we are headed. We want to hear from you. Give us a call. Do you think updating our nuclear weapons will boost our national security, or are you worried about another arms race? Here's our number in Washington, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. To start us off, we turn to our own science correspondent, David Kestenbaum, who is here with us in Studio 3A. David, thanks for being here.
Sure. Hi, Frank.
How old is the current stockpile?
Well, we have a number of nuclear weapons, so you could talk about an average age. Some estimates put the average age at maybe 20 years or something. Some were designed in the 70s, some were designed later than that. There's disagreement, I think, about how many weapons we have and how many of the ones we have will work. Some people say we have 10,000 ready to go. Some people say 6,000, 7,000. What is more certain is that there is a plan underway that President Bush has written up to reduce our numbers to somewhere between 1,700 and 2,200 deployed warheads by 2012. That was an agreement with the Russians.
We're talking about warheads now and not missiles. So just to be clear about that, when we're talking about weapons, you mean warheads.
And then there's a whole issue of whether you have a weapon that's mounted and ready to go or taken offline or actually been disassembled.
So there's concern, I understand, at a couple of levels. I mean, one is that these things are contained in various containers. That, you know, you've got this warhead inside a kind of a shell casing, and we're a little bit worried about how the lifespan of that casing, right? I mean, that's concerning.
People will give you different answers on this, and your guests will give you different answers in a few minutes. But one line of thought goes, if we just keep replacing the parts that we think are wearing out, it should be fine. It'll last another 20, 30, 40 or more years. And then there are people who say, well, how would you feel about your car if you never drove it, but you replaced every single part, every few years, and then you wanted to be able to turn the key 60 years down the road and be absolutely positively sure it would start without ever having tested it in between. So that's the debate you're going to hear about, whether they will work now and how best to keep them going.
And, of course, now we're operating under some limits on that testing. When was the last time our weapons, the U.S. weapons, were tested?
There were about 1,000 nuclear tests in all, and the last one was September of 1992, and we've joined a ban on testing.
And there is some kind, we use computer modeling at this point to determine whether or not these things are likely to fire?
The bulk of the money for the nuclear weapons program right now is to maintain the stockpile. It's about $6.6 billion. And a lot of that goes to trying to understand the weapons. We have computer simulations, there's a big laser, and people trying to research how the materials hold up over time.
This is probably a difficult question because it spans such a large span of time. But how does the maintenance budget compare to the construction budget, say, at the height of the Cold War when we were building these things?
I don't know the answer to that. You're better off asking one of your
guests. Yeah, it's a hard question to answer because it depends on where you are, if you're talking about the early 60s, 70s, or that sort of thing.
The weapons lab, there's also some desire to keep the weapons labs, open and busy and to keep a pool of people who know how these things work and can work on them and think about them and understand the issues that come up in the future.
So now let's talk about this potential new generation of weapons, these so-called bunker busters. What are they? How are they supposed to work?
I think people would argue with the term new generation. I mean, the idea – so the basic problem is that there are a lot of things that are being buried. A lot of Iran is apparently burying some of its nuclear facilities, and there was a government report that said there are 10,000 military facilities that are being hidden and buried underground. And dirt, it turns out, is a very good way to defend yourself against all the technology and arsenal of the United States and any other advanced country. Because once you bury something 50 or 100 feet underground, it's very, very hard to get it. Dirt is just a very good shield. So we actually have a nuclear bunker buster, as it's called, robust nuclear earth penetrator. And it's basically a very long, gigantic nail with an explosive in the back of it. And the idea is that you shoot this at your buried target, and the nail disintegrates as it goes, but it plows some number of feet underground, and it gets the explosive underground where it can do the most damage. And so there was money in the budget last year, though Congress decided not to fund it, to study and not developing, they would say, new weapons, but taking existing weapons and figuring out how to better mount them on a penetrator and get at a deeply buried target. I should also make clear that the total budget for this is on the order of, $4-8 million out of a total budget of $6 billion.
What about the delivery systems? Are we talking about changing the delivery systems? Would we have to scrap what we have and come up with a whole new line of missiles to get these things where they're headed?
I think they're looking at modifying things like the tip and the size of the explosive.
And I guess when you talk about burying the nuclear technology, in other words, a potential enemy has the ability to fairly inexpensively hide their stuff, their infrastructure. It does suggest that whatever you develop as a weapon, there's always a counter move, that this is a dynamic process.
Right. I mean, one of the things that critics will argue is that, for instance, suppose someone buries a target in the middle of a populated area, you're not going to want to go in there with a nuke on the back of a big nail and try and hit it, because you're always going to get fallout. And if anybody's near there, they're not going to survive.
One of the arguments I've seen, though, is that with these so-called bunker busters, that that you limit the nuclear fallout because it explodes deep underground.
You can ask your guests about this, but there are people who have said that once you fire the nail into the target, you get a deep hole, and the explosion happens at the end of that hole. But that's going to propel a lot of. I don't think there's anyone who believes you don't get fallout when you with a robust nuclear earth penetrator with a bunker buster.
And then this raises the question, too, if this is a new kind of weapon, what do you do to test it? Currently, the United States is abiding by a test ban treaty, so we don't do tests.
Right.
Would you
have to do
some kind of an active test to make sure this thing works? Would you have to change the treaty?
Well, the Department of Energy will say that what they're doing now is just looking at how to take existing weapons and make a better bunker buster out of them. So at this point, not designing a new nuclear weapon per se.
800-989-8255 is the number to call if you want to join our conversation. We're talking about what to do with the U.S. nuclear arsenal as it ages, whether we should look to develop some new weapons and how to maintain the old ones. And to get a sense of where we are in the debate about the nation's nuclear stockpile, we're going to hear from a few analysts. But first, I want to talk to Frank Gaffney, who's a Defense Department official under the Reagan administration and president of the Center for Security Policy, a Washington think tank, who's with us in Studio 3A. Frank Gaffney, welcome.
Thank you.
Do you think our stockpile adequately protects us? Do we have what we need to be safe in this world?
The problem isn't the numbers. The problem is that, as was indicated earlier, these weapons were designed decades ago. And they were designed for a very different kind of deterrent mission than the one we face today, specifically deterring the Soviet Union. And over the period of time that these weapons have been in our arsenal, specifically during the period of the past 12 or so, 13 years now, when we have not conducted nuclear tests, they have become both aged, of course, and I'm afraid obsolescent. They're not as safe as we know how to make them. Their reliability is a matter now of conjecture rather than certitude. And the likelihood is that even if they were, in fact, perfect in terms of meeting their specifications, they would be inappropriate to the kind of challenges that we may face in the future. And if they're not credible as deterrents, they probably are not going to do the job we need them to do.
Well, given the challenge we face, and we assume that it's mostly at this moment terrorism, what good are nuclear weapons at all?
Nuclear weapons may be the weapon of last resort against terrorist-sponsoring states that are emerging as nuclear powers, or certainly nuclear wannabe powers. Having weapons designs that are suitable to what those nations, those regimes value most, which it turns out is not the same thing as what the Soviet Union valued most, is, I think, just eminent common sense. There is, it should be said, no other aspect of the United States military that has been put on hold for the past 10, 12, 15 years. There is no other aspect, I would suggest, of government activity that people have said, let's just put it all on the shelf and hope that it'll work. You know, I'm struck by the fact that many of the same people who are most insistent that we refrain from doing any testing of nuclear weapons, which would address all of the concerns that I've just mentioned, are the same people who are most insistent that we have to test ballistic missile defenses in the most realistic imaginable way. And it does seem to me that for the same reasons that you would want to test ballistic missile defenses, you would want to test tanks and aircraft and other things, the single most important weapons in the arsenal ought to be tested on a periodic, safe, careful basis. And we haven't been doing it, and I think it's malign neglect that could cost us dearly.
I want to get back to something you said about the difference between the Soviet Union and their expectations and values versus those states that may sponsor terrorism. If your suggestion is that they don't value their population centers the way the Soviets did, and that our sort of the blackmail that we held in each other accountable to wouldn't work as well on these countries as it did in the Soviet Union if we destroyed population centers?
No, I'm saying something different. Frankly, it's hard for Americans to appreciate this, but it's typical of totalitarian systems that they don't really care very much about their populations. What we believe the Soviets held most dear was their ability to destroy us, and consequently, our nuclear deterrent posture was structured around being able to defeat their ability to do that, and to have assured second strike capability to do that. It's a different deal than what we have to confront today from an Iran and North Korea, who also don't care about their people, but who value different things, including the regime itself.
Our conversation about America's nuclear arsenal continues in a moment. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking with NPR's David Kestenbaum about whether the U.S. government needs to improve, expand, or perhaps reduce, but in other ways modify its nuclear weapons stockpile. And we're also joined by Frank Gaffney, President and CEO of the Center for Security Policy. It's a Washington think tank, and he was a Defense Department official under President Reagan. And we're taking your phone calls this hour at 800-989-8255 to talk about what the United States should do to protect, preserve, and perhaps advance its nuclear stockpile. And David, there are some other possibilities in terms of some of the changes that are suggested now, ways to perhaps improve the nuclear stockpile.
In the new proposed budget, there is money for something called the Reliable Replacement Warhead Program. And this has actually been around in various forms for a while. But the idea is basically that what we have now in the arsenal are sort of Swiss watches. You know, they're designed people were trying to use as little nuclear material as possible and get the biggest bang they could possibly get. And they're almost designed, they're as well designed as you can make them sort of within the laws of physics. But that also raises questions about their reliability. How long are they going to hold up? So one idea is maybe we should go back to the sort of rotary phone version instead of the cell phone and get something that's simpler, that maybe doesn't use plutonium, that maybe that's a little heavier. I mean, the first fat man and little boy were all 10 feet long, and some of these nuclear weapons are very small. So why not make them a little larger and a little more reliable and a little more clunky?
All right. Well, thank you very much, NPR's David Kestenbaum. Frank Gaffney, what do you think about those weapons? Are they more reliable? Would they last longer? And would they be as effective?
Well, having this conversation in sort of the abstract is a little difficult. There are real-world practical considerations that also pertain. For example, we have missiles that have been designed to carry a certain size warhead. And if you want to make one a lot bigger, a lot clunkier, a lot less switch watch, you wind up having to redesign the missile, which is a very big deal. even if that's not a big deal, I just have to bring you back to this point. Are we going to put nuclear weapons into our inventory for the first time in our history without having conducted a test on them? I don't think so, and I can't imagine that people would think that's responsible. You know, the idea initially when we started talking about a test moratorium, and by the way, we are not constrained by a test ban. The United States Senate had a very rigorous debate about this treaty to ban all nuclear testing that Bill Clinton offered up back in, I believe it was 1997, and they rejected it. And a majority of the Senate rejected it because I think they appreciated nuclear testing was necessary to maintain a credible, safe, and reliable deterrent. And in the case of these so-called reliable nuclear devices, the idea initially was, when we started talking about a unilateral moratorium back in 1992, was let's have these reliable, robust devices in the stockpile before we stop testing. But we didn't. And we've wound up lurching into a realm where I believe we currently face a very serious erosion. In fact, the House Armed Services Committee some years ago called it erosion by design in our nuclear deterrent. We need to resume on a periodic basis nuclear testing as part of a responsible maintenance program for nuclear weapons, whether they are of a more robust type, whether they are of a specialized type, whether they're designed to test the effects of nuclear weapons, which, by the way, is another problem that has not been addressed thus far, if I could just say a word about it. There was a Blue Ribbon Commission that found an effect called electromagnetic pulse could be used by terrorists, or certainly state sponsors of terror that have nuclear weapons, with catastrophic effects on our society as well as our military. We need to understand that phenomenon and fix it.
Yeah, but one of the problems, of course, is in understanding it by testing in the open air underground is that you create that effect and subject human beings to the possible outcome and the fallout.
No, but of course we're testing only underground these days. We haven't done atmospheric testing for a long time, and you can do tests on the hardware that you were interested in seeing how the electromagnetic pulse would influence their performance underground.
I want to bring in another guest now. Richard Garwin is with us. He's a longtime defense consultant, former nuclear weapons designer for Los Alamos Laboratories, and he joins us from Yorktown Heights, New York. Richard Garwin, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
What should the United States do about this nuclear arsenal it has? You've heard some of the conversation so far. Should we be resuming nuclear testing to check for the reliability and safety of these weapons?
In a word, no. We never did test for reliability. We tested for design. We tested for effects. But we had weapons in the stockpile for 15 and 20 years and didn't worry about them. We have a stockpile stewardship program of more than 20 years standing, whereby each year we take out of the inventory 11 weapons of each kind and inspect them very carefully, tear one of them down, destroy it essentially in the process. And those things that seem in danger of aging, we replace. Now, the car analogy really is invalid. We do turn these things on. We fire them in simulation systems. That is, we take out the uranium and the plutonium, but the rest of it is right there. We fire them while they are in flight, and we've learned a lot from that, and we fix those things which are not the nuclear components. The only things that we can't test the way they're going to be used in war are not the explosives. We can test that, but the contained uranium, plutonium, and then the so-called secondary of the hydrogen bomb.
Let's go to the phones. Reed is on the line from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hello, Reed.
Hi, good afternoon.
Mm-hmm. You have a question for us?
Yes, sir. I was wondering, a little bit off topic, but still pertinent, in the global community that we are all residing in now, how does the U.S. defend its position of not allowing other countries to move forward with new nuclear weapons, and yet we're going to do the exact same?
Well, I might put the question to Frank Gaffney. Is that do we have the moral posture that's required for this?
Well, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, also known as the NPT, which was signed back in the 60s, basically made a distinction between the haves and the have-nots. The United States was one of, at the time, five nuclear powers that were explicitly authorized to have nuclear weapons. They had to make certain commitments of a general character to work for disarmament, and we certainly have. But it was understood and practiced that the United States and the other nuclear powers would retain nuclear weapons. I personally think we've put to the test this idea that if we exercise this restraint that many have encouraged us to engage in on nuclear testing and other aspects of our nuclear program, that will constrain those states that were not supposed to get into the nuclear weapons business. It hasn't worked, and I don't think it will work. They're not constrained by our behavior or lack of it. Their calculations are driven by their own strategic interests.
Reed, thank you for your call. Does it accelerate the race, though, if the United States openly, you know, resumes testing?
I don't think so. I just would argue that when we demonstrate a lack of credibility or concern about the credibility of our deterrent, and I think that's what we're doing at the moment, it invites others, particularly those, by the way, who are allies of ours and who have heretofore relied upon our nuclear deterrent to think differently and perhaps pursue their own.
Richard Garwin?
I'm not demonstrating a lack of credibility or concern about our deterrent. It's Frank Gaffney who is doing that. And he doesn't really have a basis for doing it. As I say, we test the hell out of these things. There's no doubt that the plutonium is going to work. If it doesn't, build new pits. But we have these internals from the weapons. Some of them are 30 years old. Some of them are more. We have accelerated tests. We can build more. We ought to reduce the numbers, as your other guest says. The numbers don't really matter, and we have a lot more than we need. The cost of maintaining them in good shape is higher when you have lots of numbers. What would happen first if we went back to testing is that China would test. We've had more than 1,000 tests. China has had only 40-some tests. And we would be most concerned about the progress that China would be making with their tests in developing better nuclear weapons.
Well, Richard, I think Frank's point is, if I may, Frank, is that, they're going to do that anyway. There's nothing that we've done or haven't done in the past that's changed the attitude of those who may be seen.
In fact, the Chinese have signed and ratified the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, and they show every sign of holding on to it. But surely, if we began to test, they would. There's certainly no indication that they would resist testing if we began to test.
Frank Gaffney, what about Richard Garwin's point that we do test and replace a lot of the key components in these things? They're tested, they're replaced, they're modified, we know they're going to work. They are tested.
Yeah, it's just not science. That's faith-based stewardship. And it's true that we do all of that, but in the end, what we found, including during the period when we were doing testing, always were surprises, including about the reliability of weapons. What we are not doing now is proving everything that we think through the simulation, through our theories, through our observations is going on. And if, in fact, we're wrong, well, he rather blithely says, well, we can build some new pits, but we're not going to know we need new pits, let alone be able to build new pits, without having tested them to prove that we were wrong in the first place, something that we're currently not doing. The scientists at the moment are quite convinced everything is perfect, as you're just hearing him say, when there's no means of double-checking whether they're right. And that seems to me to be folly.
Let's go.
We have a lot of means of checking. In fact, we do the implosions, that is, the plutonium or the uranium driven by the explosives, and we look at them just as we did before. In the days when we had every opportunity to test, we did not test. And right now, the weapons laboratory directors certify each year that our stockpile is reliable and safe without testing.
Are we talking about individual weapons, or are we talking about weapon systems? The weapon systems, it seems to me, we've tested, and they're in place because we have a sense that they work. That's why they're in place.
A weapon system cannot work if its warhead doesn't work. So I'm talking about the weapon itself, the nuclear weapon itself. In its radiation case, with its arming, firing, and fusing components, all of these things are thoroughly tested except the nuclear explosion. Now, this doesn't address the problem of the missiles, for instance, the interceptors that can't get out of their silos. That's a different problem. and you could eliminate the effectiveness of the deterrent that way. But the nuclear explosive is going to work.
That's where we disagree, Richard. And saying that aside from the nuclear weapons part of this is like saying aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how'd you like
to
play?
Let me ask you, how do you
test? It's the whole point.
How do you test? You're not talking about testing individual weapons as they're in the ground. You can't do that because they blow up. It's a one-time thing. So you're testing the system itself, right?
You're testing. We have 9 weapons designs in the arsenal today. 1 of those 9 have all of the features for safety and controllability and security that we know how to build into these weapons. What you would do, typically, if you were to do a nuclear test, is take one of those designs, ideally off the shelf, out of the stockpile, put it down in a prepared hole with all of the necessary instrumentation, detonate it, not at full yield, but at partial yield, to demonstrate both the performance of the primary and of the secondary, and thereby confirm conclusively that all of the things you've changed, all of the things that you've tested, all of the things that you've worked on through your simulations and so on, actually come together and work the way they're supposed to, when they're supposed to, and won't when they're not.
We are talking about America's aging nuclear arsenal, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
But in fact, that is not how we test. When we test underground, we don't use all the features of the weapon. Our weapons are adequately safe and secure. There's absolutely no problem about that. The problem is one, the concern is reliability. The fact that not every weapon has the most advanced safety features is compensated by how we deal with the weapons. We can always think of better safety, better security, and we have thought of it. We haven't put it in. At the beginning of the moratorium in 1992, the military and the nuclear weapons, the Department of Energy, were given the option of 15 nuclear explosion tests for improving reliability and safety.
And then that option was taken away from them, Richard.
No, they didn't.
I was there at the time. It was taken away from
them. I want to let our callers have a chance to get in on this conversation, so I'm going to bring Steve in from Minneapolis. Hello, Steve.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It seems to me the discussion about the nuclear stockpile that we have misses the obvious point that we're actually creating offensive weapons here. I mean, that's where the discussion is leading to, whether or not we should have an offensive nuclear war. The stockpiles were designed as a deterrent against a first strike, and were never actually intended to be used. Seems a little silly to build offensive weapons when of such destructive magnitude. I think the only moral and responsible thing that we should be doing or considering is actually dismantling every nuclear bomb in our arsenal, as well as encouraging other countries to do the same.
Well, you'll be very pleased to know, Steve, that's essentially what we're doing. I'm arguing against it. I think that that is actually dangerous, that it will in fact lead the United States into a preposterous situation of being the nuclear power without nuclear weapons. I believe that we need to maintain a small but competent and credible nuclear deterrent that is safe and reliable. And that does not require necessarily having, in fact, I would argue against having these very large yield weapons, which we currently have. Those are indeed offensive weapons that I think it makes less and less sense for us to have in the stockpile today.
Richard Garwin, we have about 30 seconds left.
So-called a bunker buster is not a low-yield weapon, and it does not have to penetrate deeply into the ground to get its maximum effect. If it goes down 6 feet, that's enough. And so the effort that is being made now to build such things is really misguided. We can get that kind of penetration with high explosive assists to our nuclear weapons. We're just not doing these things very smartly, and the idea that we need to have new types of nuclear weapons is so dominant with people like your guest that they cannot see what is really required to have a reliable, small deterrent stockpile.
All right, Richard Garwin, defense consultant, former nuclear weapons designer for Los Alamos Laboratories, thank you very much for joining us. Frank Gaffney, president and CEO of the Center for Security Policy, a Washington think tank, and former Defense Department official under President Reagan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank.
And NPR's David Kestenbaum, thank you for joining in this conversation about America's nuclear arsenal. When we come back, the Shiite majority's choice for Iraqi prime minister and the children of U.S. immigrants making gains. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.